On Human Services and the subcommittee will now come to order. I see where the nursing committee are packed in today. Actually, there's nothing against your bill. It's just that we made a few calls. I'm glad you're here, though. So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1034 for possible reconsideration. The chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow a motion to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1034 did not receive the required majority to report it out to the full committee. Are there any objections? The chair will accept the motion to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1034 did not receive the required majority to report it out to the full committee.
So moved, Manager.
Okay. Senator Representative Nathanson moved to reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1034 did not receive the required majority to report out to the full committee. Are there any objections? Motion carries. The bill is back before the subcommittee. Your pleasure? Move to adopt? Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Move to adopt.
Move to adopt, yeah.
Yes.
And
the vice chair has arrived.
Thank you. Representative Nathanson moves Senate Bill 1034 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Seeing none. Thank you very much. Senate Bill 1034 has been adopted. I'd like to have a carrier, Representative Boone. Mr. Carrier,
sure,
thank you very much. To full committee and on the floor, Senator Bortley, would you like to carry this on the Senate floor? Thank you very, very much. I will now open. Seems like I'm organized. We'll now open a work session, public hearing on House Bill 1531, the Department of Human Services, Seniors, and People with Disabilities. Senator Winters.
Before you open the hearing, could I just, yesterday we talked about the longevity of the long-term care system and recognize some individuals, and I would just like to take the opportunity to recognize a person that I know that's her heart and her hard work has been here since I was in Children's Services Division, and that was Lucille Pugh. I don't think that there's anybody in this building who has worked this hard on welfare and senior issues in this state than Ms. Pugh.
Thank you very much and welcome. Thank you, Senator Winters. That was very kind. I want to say something regarding especially an issue that continues to come up, and that's the OPI bill. Our reason for, along with several of the lobbyists from last session, wanting to have more stable funding for OPI. That's why we chose to put it in the senior deferral program so that you would have a more stable funding. And it was the people who were the lobbyists for seniors and people with disabilities, as well as some of us, the speaker included, who felt that it would be very good so that we can have stable funding. We have a source we could always go to in order to fund OPI. My computer, I don't know about the rest of you guys, my emails are so strong, I don't want anybody to believe I haven't heard one word on this committee other than the fact they want to support seniors. The senior deferral program was the program by which we felt would produce the highest amount of dollars and would give you the most stable funding that you need. Because every year trying to get OPI funded was like a roller coaster. And it was, can we get the votes? How much money can we get? And where do we go from here? So I have not heard one committee person voice and a dissent towards senior services and people with disabilities in any kind of way. So you're speaking to the choir when you come here today. people who support you, people who want to make sure that there is stable funding for you. So I just want to make sure that I make that clear on the record before we go any further. Mr. Britton, Senator Morissette.
I did carry that bill last time, and I did have conversations about the stable funding aspect, and I must say that I honestly thought that that would be supplemental funding and not the only source. I really thought that there would be some general fund money put into it to sustain it. The governor, I think, put more money in it. You know, the governor was thinking about that. Unfortunately, money has been taken out, and because the amount was more than adequate, we leveled it off to make it go over the biennium, and by that we reduced it. I would much have preferred that we do a general fund supplement because we're still not dealing with the disabled population, and probably never will. The way the bill is worded, we may never get adequate funding for OPI, so we may never deal with the disabled people. So I guess I would continue to push, if not this biennium, next biennium, for some general fund support for OPI, as well as the dedicated funding.
Okay, and one thing I want to make clear, too, that because we did not, as a legislative assembly, support the budget at the level in which the governor had it, we've not been able to raise the funds. We've not been able to raise the funds. All the revenues, the governor had approximately $829 million in revenue-raising dollars. I would love nothing more than for the Senate and the House to pass the revenue-raising bills that have been before us. You and I both know there's a political problem. The Senate could pass it, the House couldn't. So where do you go? You still have an enhanced version of your budget. You just don't have as much, Senator, as you did with the governor's enhanced amount. So that's where the problem comes from. I just don't want any perceptions to be left here that members of this committee want to see seniors receive any less than what we can get in celibacy seniors and people with disabilities. I hope we can get more money so that we can answer the issue to most of you that have raised the issue, including myself, about the disability piece.
Senator Borley.
Thank you. I appreciate the comments of the chair and also of Senator Morissette. And I just want to put on record again what I have stated recently. The Senior and Disability Caucus is of the position that OPI should be funded through the general fund, and that's recognizing the existing political reality, but it's still the preference of the Senior and Disability Caucus that OPI be funded through the general fund. And as a member of that caucus, I will continue to remind this panel and the full Ways and Means panel and the entire legislature that is the desire of the Senior Disability Caucus in this session.
Okay.
And that, again, points up the need for more revenue.
Absolutely.
Given the situation that we face with Well, let me just end by saying there is an opportunity on Thursday at 1 o'clock in Representative Barnhart's Revenue Committee for folks who support revenue reform to come and testify on House Bill 2530. That's the first opportunity in this session that I'm aware of for folks to start weighing in on what the future could look like if we were to capture sufficient revenue to pay for the services that Oregonians need and deserve. That's the opportunity, and let's let's promote that.
Absolutely.
And let's participate in the hearings as well.
Further discussion? Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we began yesterday with the Department of Human Services Seniors and People with Disabilities budget presentation, and we're prepared to continue that presentation this afternoon. I have some handouts, and there were some handouts at your places that need to go into your notebooks, and as we get to discussions about caseload and some other things, I'll have additional handouts for you this afternoon. I also have responses to some questions that were raised back in the, I guess, April 10th, when Ms. Baker and I went through the co-chair's budget with all of you, and I will hand those out right now, but we could go ahead with Mr. Taves and the presentation.
Great. Mr. Taves, will you join us?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services Senior and Disability Programs, and with me today is Julia Huddleston, who heads up our planning and research section. Today, we would like to focus particularly on the long-range plan that's described in some detail in the book, both the implications for the short-term and for the long-term, and actually it's real germane to the conversation you have just had, because we're beginning to look at how a fund like OPI could actually be used much more strategically in the future as part of our long-range plan. If you turn to page 25 of the book, when Senator Winters was asking us yesterday about the numbers, this is the chart that we've been using that's census data trended forward, and it pretty dramatically shows, as is true in most of the country, that the population over age 65 will double within the next 20 years, coming of the boomers. The population will absolutely double. Oregon is one of the fastest aging states in the country. In fact, by the end of this decade, Oregon will be the fourth oldest state. Not only does the overall population double, but you can see that the group that is over age 85 actually grows by a third. And of course, the older you get, the more likely that at some point you will need actual paid, publicly supported long-term care.
I'm there, and I want to make sure that they have the money.
Madam Chair, on the next two pages, 26 and 27, I want to gloss over those and we'll come back to them. We simply took the percentage of the population that is typically receiving paid long-term care and trended that forward over the next 20 years, both the population demographic and then the cost. But we're going to show you some more information around costs. Every dollar you see here is a $2,005 or $2,006, even when we trended it forward. So we've not added inflation or other kinds of cost pressures that will occur in the future. But for simple comparison purposes, it's today's dollars trended forward. Beginning on page 28, for the last 3 years, we've engaged in an extensive long-range planning exercise. The governor directed us to develop a long-range plan. 3 years ago, we convened a large task force of stakeholders. We broke into 8 or 9 subcommittees and have done extensive work around key questions on what our entire long-term care support system should look like as we look at this huge, almost tidal wave of seniors and people with disabilities that are coming our way. After the first draft, we actually last spring went on the road in conjunction with the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We went to, I think, 8 or 9 places around the state and did a series of video conferences as well. And we took that overall demographic, and I'll just have Julia show you. We tried to take census data by every local community to try to bring home. Many of us sit back, we hear the national numbers and the state numbers, and they appear somewhat staggering. But we tried to actually help people visualize at a very local level what this aging demographic can look like. And I just want to have Julia show you by example what we presented in each community.
Okay, Chair Carter, members of the committee, Julia Huddleston for the record. In front of you, you have these 8.5 by 11 sheets, 8.5 by 14,
that start out with Multnomah County with Clatsop County underneath. There's a packet like this for every county in the state that we distributed at these meetings, and it's available on the SPD website. And what we tried to do was your furthest left-hand column over is some comparative statistics on that first page for Oregon. And then we looked at those comparative averages of Oregon versus, on that top example, Multnomah County, and drew attention to the fact that, for example, right now, Oregon's 13% plus over age 65 and Multnomah's slightly younger. We looked at information around poverty and home ownership rates. We looked at some information around race and ethnicity.
Madam Chair. Can I ask a question, a definition on the race and ethnicity population? Where you have multiracial, what is that definition? How do you define multiracial?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, these are U.S. Census definitions. I believe this is people who report themselves as multiracial, but I will clarify that and respond back to you.
So if you have a mixture of races...
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, and if you report that you have a mixture of races and you're multiracial, that's where you'd fall. Yeah.
Would you bring a definition, please? Thank
you. I certainly will.
I'm going to see where I fit.
Well, and Chair Carter and Senator Winters, I believe with all census information, it's wherever you want to fit. So let me just say that straight up front.
So, you know, at some place I would hope we'd have one box that says human being.
I would hope. We looked at the growth rate of the aging populations in every county versus the growth rate of the population of the county as a whole. So this chart right there, the way you would read that is from 2000 to 2005, the overall population of Multnomah County increased by 4%. The percentage of that population that was over 65 decreased by 4%. There's all the in-migration coming in. And what's projected for 2005 to 2015 is a 7% increase in the overall population, 26% in the over 65, and then we trended it forward to 2025. Every county's first page works the same way. If you go on to the second page, you've got some pie charts. I apologize for the grayscale. It doesn't turn out quite as dramatic as it should. But if you look at the grayscale on that 2006, the overall, the biggest piece of the pie, naturally, is the under 65 population. And they made up 89% of the Multnomah County population in 2005. The slightly darker piece that says 5%, that's people aged 65 to 74. A little bit darker still, 4%, is 75 to 84. And that piece there that's white is the over 85 population, 2%. So Multnomah County, if you walk through all these, and we made this point, Multnomah County's aging. Multnomah County goes from 1 in 9 people over 65 in 2005 to, if you follow the progression through, 1 in 6 by 2025. But if you look at, for example, the Vice Chairs County, Clatsop County, Clatsop County is right now 1 in 7 people are over the age of 65. By the time we hit 2025 in Clatsop County, it'll be one person out of every four will be 65 plus. So we made that point that the aging demographic is different in every state of the county. Gave some generic information for each county around the availability of physicians, hospitals, nursing homes, and community-based care facilities. And then moving on to the third page, just looked at some national markers and did some predictors.
Just a quick question. Are these numbers where it says count, is that total? Like, I'm looking at Clatsop County's community facilities, it says 155.
Chair Carter, Representative Boone, that was a total count of residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, and adult foster homes within the county borders as of, for this date, of the end of 2005.
And then what does available mean?
That there were, in that total capacity, there were that many living units available. Now, a living unit could be an apartment in an assisted living, or it could be a bed in an adult foster
home.
That's what
I was wondering. It isn't quite
me. And then occupied, of course, were how many people were there. And this is Medicaid and private pay, so this would be all markets, all payer sources.
So count is follow.
Count
is the facility available, the beds.
Mm-hmm. And occupied are the beds with somebody in them.
Okay.
On page 3 of each county display, we took a little bit of national information from the 2002 National Health and Retirement Study that looked at a big sample of seniors and predicted how many seniors had a need for assistance with activities of daily living. We also looked at some data from that same study on where seniors' incomes fall comparatively. And you can see it demonstrates there's, and again, I apologize for the grayscale, but roughly 35% of seniors have incomes less than $1,600 a month nationally. And then looked at some, just extrapolated some of that data into the Multnomah County overall population. These people could be predicted to need long-term care. So by 2025, 7% of people in Multnomah County, which would be about 56,000, might need long-term care. They all might not access it. Certainly, it would not all be formal long-term care, and certainly the smallest part would be paid for by Medicaid. But that could be the predicted need, just given the demographic. And then the last page of every county's display is the same. It's Oregon information. And in its simplest way, the population of the state of Oregon in 2005 was about 3.7 million people. And those 3.7 million people are predicted to grow to about 4.7 million in 2025. The aging population that was about 460,000 in 2005 will be about 860,000 people in the year 2025. So that's the demographic that's looking at us. And again, all these, every county's detail and display is available on our website.
So, Madam Chair, part of the purpose of doing this was to tee up the conversation in each community, because where this is going to lead us, we believe, is a community-by-community plan by the time we're done over a multiple-year planning process that will actually predict numbers of programs you'll need in your local community, what the workforce gap may be, what the Medicaid capacity, private pay capacity. We actually hope to have a very detailed sort of map for every local community, because in part we have to engage community leaders, city councils, commissioners, local elected officials, everyone. This isn't simply a senior and disability services division issue. It is a very, very broad social issue. I want to mention also, in terms of all the data, that we have excellent census data on aging demographics. We have less good data on disability characteristics. So wherever we've included people with disabilities, we've simply extrapolated typical population growth demographics. But that is the conversation that we've attempted to tee up in each local community.
Senator Morse?
thank you. I was just looking at my county, Lane County, and available beds, 2,182, occupied 2,102. There are not enough available beds. There are nursing homes, but not assisted living. Now, in Lane County, I believe, or maybe it's Lincoln County, there's at least one assisted living that has discontinued the Medicaid patients. And is that a trend? And are we going to be able to build new assisted living? I mean, we're running out of space already.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, excuse me, Senator Morissette, we actually are losing Medicaid capacity in multiple areas of the state. We're going to talk about it some tomorrow. It is a major concern of ours, particularly given this demographic trend, but we're actually seeing a shrinking of our Medicaid capacity, and the disparity between Medicaid and private pay rates is growing, which is contributing to the issue.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bourdain.
Thank you very much. Are you working on the capacity to capture disability data?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordo, yes, we are.
And what does that look like? Details, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we met with a group of people with disabilities through the summer and the early fall, attempting to capture some like markers for people with disabilities as we were able to for seniors. We identified several of them. The research and planning staff is engaged in an effort to attempt to identify more. It's a very difficult task because of the multiple definitions of disabilities and the self-reported nature of the information that's widely gathered, but we continue to work on it.
Madam Chair, to continue, the planning we're focusing on now really has two parts, and one is how to help communities and families and individuals prepare for themselves to do their own planning for their eventual long-term care needs. And as most of us know, often families and individuals don't do that. They wait until sort of that catastrophic event of a stroke or a fall or something like that precipitates long-term care. And our goal is to begin a very widespread awareness campaign at the local level of the need to plan. Many people don't plan. A, B, they think Medicaid or Medicare will cover the costs of their long-term care, and in most cases it will not. It will only cover short-term nursing facility types of costs, and often families don't realize, but their parents or themselves will have to spend down and impoverish themselves eventually to be eligible for Medicaid services. And if you do polling and surveying across the country, most people simply are not aware of that. So our goal, A, is to help people to plan for themselves, to look at a series of self-support strategies in each community. And if you look at Chapter 410 of our enabling legislation, crafted by people like Lucille Pugh and others, they had a very broad public mission in mind, where our statute actually says we should be doing broad-based counseling, care option planning, financial planning, things of that sort, which over the years we've done less and less of. We've shrunk more and more to sort of a Medicaid, publicly financed long-term care system. And again, most seniors and people with disabilities will not need formal long-term care. And particularly we can lessen that statistic if we provide lots of support to communities to do their own planning.
One question, Mr. Tate. Should that be the role of your department, or should that be in the Ombudsperson's office?
Madam Chair, I actually think that is perfectly the role of the area agencies on aging.
Okay.
They have a federal mandate. They have the Older Americans Act. They have OPI, which is a non-Medicaid fund source. And if you look at their mission in statute in particular, that was originally envisioned, that they would have such a broad role to do planning and care options and things of that sort. So we think that fits perfectly with an expanded mission for our current field structure. Then we're looking at Congress has passed, and this is to get into the details of some of this long-range planning. Congress has now passed a series of potential options that the states can use. One is long-term care insurance reform, which is called the Partnership Act, which allows states, based on models from four different states, to help people pre-plan through long-term care insurance and then exempt at the other end any recovery of their estate. So we can incentivize and say, if you pre-plan up to, say, a $250,000 limit, if at a point in time you exhaust that long-term care insurance, you spend down, you need Medicaid, we will not come in then and recover your estate up to that amount. So it incentivizes people who want to leave money to their children or to their heirs. And it appears from the states that have modeled this that it actually deepens the penetration of long-term care insurance. Oregon is one of some states that has tax incentives, but it doesn't appear to really change the percentage of people that access long-term care insurance.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morsett?
James, didn't we pass, I carried a bill on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, Senate Bill 191, yes, passed your committee.
I feel remiss in my duty because I didn't take the time to explain that bill adequately when I carried it. So I guess I will use my remonstrance time to go back and do that. No, that's a good bill, and I feel badly that I didn't really take the time. So I
it's a very important bill, and again, but it covers only a percentage of seniors and people with disabilities
yeah,
for whom
right.
affordable long-term insurance will really work. The other key things that the federal government is allowing us to pursue, one is called Money Follows the Person. Oregon has a proposal into the federal government that we would propose to move about another 700 people, even though Oregon has about the lowest per capita institutionalization rate. We would propose to move another 700 or so people over a five-year period into community-based facilities. We have several goals in mind there. One, we get an enhanced federal match for at least a full year after the person relocates if they've lived in a long-term care nursing home or institution for over 6 months of about 80-20. We capture about 80% match as opposed to 60% match. And we're actually hoping to pilot some wraparound models that we can serve people with even higher acuity needs, dementia, the geriatric population, and some other folks that we could do some real tightly expanded wraparound medical, nursing, and other social supports that would allow us to serve another group of folks with complex needs in community settings, which I think would put Oregon even further ahead from where other states are trying to go.
Senator Winters?
Mr. Keynes, as Oregon has led the way on OPI, and we have not, as I understand, got the federal government to follow our lead, is there any discussion with our congressional delegation of others so that we, or whether we could get a waiver so that we can get some federal assistance with our OPI, or at least get some match for the dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we're going to get to that in just a second because we have thoughts, at least, whether the federal government will.
I'm just the head of the. Sorry.
So we're going to get to that in just a second here. The other two options that the federal government has offered us, which we're really investigating now, the federal regulations are not out. One we described yesterday, which is called a new 1915J waiver, to be bureaucratic, which is expanded independent choices where people who are capable could manage their own lives. And then the other option that we think could really fit well in Oregon is called a 1915I waiver. And what that is basically a state plan option where you could uncouple your eligibility from your institutional level of care need. What happened since 1981, when the first home and community-based waivers that Oregon pursued were created, basically the federal legislation has not changed in 25 years. States, most states have waivers, not as big as Oregon's, but most states have waivers. And yet, here 25 years later, we're still going through all these hoops to get these waivers when, in fact, it really has become part of our long-term care Medicaid system. Congress has now said you can create a new state plan option that's stable, predictable. It's not based on a waiver, and it's not tied to an institutional level of care. So we could create benefit packages tied expressly to people's needs, provide that level of benefit instead of saying, you know, you only need 10 hours a month of in-home care, but we have to declare you eligible for nursing facility care in order to get that 10 hours. And oh, by the way, by having created your eligibility over here, no matter what your needs are, you can pick any option from A to Z, even though it may be beyond your needs, less than your needs. So Congress is really allowing us here to look at an option that can really be tailored, almost like a benefit package tied to needs as opposed to this vastly expanded institution.
What is being uncoupled?
What's being uncoupled is your eligibility can, you still have to meet the financial eligibility for Medicaid, but your eligibility can be based on your discrete care needs instead of saying you need 24-hour-a-day nursing care, which really, you know, I wouldn't say we've lied, but we've stretched that mm-hmm. definition pretty broadly. So we could capture the broadest number of people because what you're doing in a waiver is you're waiving against your institutional level of care. It was a great thing in the beginning. It's just plain nonsensical here 25 years ago, and Congress has finally realized that. So by at least the end of August, we think the regulations will be out, and we really want to drill down and see if a portion of Oregon's long-term care system would fit better in a state plan option as opposed to the waiver, which gets us to the pyramid. This is for example only, but we want to draw a picture for what, if we pursue some of these options, Oregon's system might. If you have in front of you the colored pyramid. To begin to draw a picture of what Oregon's long-term care system on the paid public side might look like if we pursued some of these options. The first page simply describes the service system as is. The number under OPI there is about 3,500 people. Then you can see the number of people that are served in each of the other categories. So that's basically caseloads as they stand in 2006. The next pages 2 through 4 are just sort of backup descriptive information, but we really want to draw your attention to pages 6 and 7.
Marissa?
Yeah, where are we?
Page 6 and 7 of the...
This is a handout.
We're all together. We're ready.
So page 6 simply trends forward all the numbers with the population demographic added to the year 2025. It takes everything on the 2006 caseload, simply trends it forward based on the population growth, and we come up with an estimate of what it would take to and the cost roughly to serve about 48,000 clients in 2025 as compared to the 28,000 clients or so that we serve in 2006. If we potentially pursue, and before I go to the next page, let me look at some of the data on here. If you look at in-home services, for example, 39%, almost 40% of the people we serve in the in-home program get less than 2 hours a day. Nonetheless, we declare that entire group to be institutionally eligible for nursing home care, given, again, the way the Medicaid waivers work. And, again, we could create a different Medicaid benefit package for this type of group in the new state plan option that's being offered by the federal government.
So that means you can carry it from 2 hours to however many hours you need necessitated.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And again, when you look at this, we're trending forward payments of about $630 million roughly for long-term care for this population from 2006, serving 2,800. Again, just expanding the system as is, still based on today's dollars, no inflation, nothing else added. We'd be up to about $1 billion a year, serving 48,000 people in the same configuration of services that we have now.
You have to ask a question that goes... not on the agenda right now. I was talking to one of our colleagues, and she was saying that we know seniors who are outside of the realm of Medicare, Medicaid, who are in the age group and have the money but would like to use the services of an OPI. Do we have a system by which these people can pay to be a part of a program of this nature?
Madam Chair, Yes, and we described a little bit, and I think we were going to get you additional information about the numbers of people over 200% of the federal poverty level that basically pay in for their OPI-type services. So, yes, OPI is a vehicle where through fees or pay-in, people can help purchase those services, but use a case manager, use the network that's in place. And in some cases, we're hoping with the home care program and the home care commission and creating a registry that we would have a natural place if you have the money and you need in-home care, you have an automatic referral place you can go to get qualified home care workers that could come into your home and perform that service even though you can pay for it.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
That's Senator Morse.
We don't have a means test for OPI. It's a voluntary program.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, it's not formally means tested, but it is. I mean, we have clear guidelines on fees between 100% of, below the 100% of the federal poverty level, you pay nothing. Between 100 and 200%, it's a graduated fee scale. And then over 200% of the federal poverty level, we expect people to pay for their services. So we don't send bill collectors or things like that, but it is primarily voluntary. But you'll see in the data that we're going to report back to you on fees that many of the area agencies on aging collect quite a bit of fees for this program.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dorley?
I'm confused. Looking at the pyramid, again, assuming the funding source in 2006, general fund, what about the property tax deferral? I'm trying to link the funding sources to what you're displaying on the pyramid.
Sure.
And I want to understand your assumptions.
Senator Carter,
forward.
Senator Gordley, all I did in any circumstance to grow 2006 to 2025 was took the payments that are being made today, basically per person, and multiplied them by a new amount of people. So there's no assumption in there about continuation of general fund or the property deferral. It's just an average payment today for a number of people times a number of people in 2025.
Further questions, Senator?
I'm just understanding the response to be a flaw in how we're looking at this picture that you want us to understand about the needs and how they're going to carry forward into 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the needs, but also the
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we make no assumptions about fund source in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
We simply say if you continue the existing service system as is, with relatively the same percentage of people served the way they are now, trended it forward, here's what it would look like, here's what it would cost in today's dollars.
Okay.
So these aren't even 2025 dollars. I mean, those will be many times higher than this because this is just today's dollars without inflation or any other cost adjustments.
Can we make the same assumption that deals with workforce, because in looking at the pyramid, you're talking about expanded nursing home, nursing facilities, in-home services, all of which will require workforce mm-hmm. increase in growth. So are you making that same assumption that this does not in any way talk about that, but the expectation is that somebody will?
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, we've actually put together a new workforce study group that's going to be doing tons of sort of just demographic work on the workforce itself. And we're applying, I think you just approved a federal grant recently to help us look at some of the workforce issues as well. The cost pressures that will come with the workforce demographic will also compound these numbers in very significant ways. So we're very concerned about it. But again, we make no assumption about those cost pressures here. We simply trend forward today's dollars, multiply it times the number of people served. So the real issue that we want to get to is on the last page, because if we go after some of the new state plan options, this is what we think the system could look like.
Mr. Britton?
Just to clarify something, if you look at page one, and I'm just ballparking this, but the total of all those annual payments, and this is annual, is about $650 million. And what the chart on page six shows you is that the cost, if we had the people that the agency is projecting we would have in terms of service, that cost today wouldn't be $650 million, it would be $1 billion. So about $350 million annually higher than it is today. And what I believe you're saying is you haven't made any assumptions about cost increases or labor shortages or anything like that, or medical increases in terms of your costs here. It's just simply showing the effect of more people using these services.
And Chair, I'd like to thank Mr. Whitten for that explanation, and I do hope that at some point in the future that those points that have been raised will come under discussion, because if you look at a plan, you have to be able to look at all those pieces.
Madam Chair, finally, page 7 is where we potentially land, and this is all draft, and I want to preface it with saying this is all draft based on planning to date, on what the system could look like in 2025 if we took a different approach. And much of the discussion in our task force and our subgroups is, if you can really support people earlier, even provide broadened pre-Medicaid supports like Oregon Project Independence, you can serve more people and potentially be able to contain the number of people and the costs in your more expensive 24-hour nursing kind of settings. Now, these numbers are highly speculative because they're out that far. But, for example, in a new state plan option, which we could well consider within the next year, we could take the in-home group, the group that is 8 hours or less a day, and say that's not really a group that's 24-hour eligible, create the benefit package in a state plan option, and then in turn change the definition of eligibility for a nursing home and also change the definition of the home and community-based waiver. So it would be a separate benefit package for people that truly have full 24-hour needs. And the rest we would do not as a waiver but as a Medicaid state plan option. And then tie that sequentially right after an expanded Oregon Project Independence and a pre-Medicaid program. So for people with really low numbers of hours, you don't sign them up for Medicaid, you don't put them on the Oregon Health Plan and do the full wraparound Medicaid services, but you provide exactly the amount of limited in-home supports that they need. With Medicare Part B, about 75% of those folks are probably eligible for the drug coverage anyway, so you've taken care of part of that issue. And back to Senator Winter's, I think, question about Medicaid, one of the things we'd like to explore with the federal government is to say, if you could develop a model combining both pre-Medicaid, like an expanded OPI, with a new state plan option, could we get a waiver, for example, to at least cover the case management or other costs in the pre-Medicaid program based on the argument that we'll slow the growth into the longer-term formal part of the Medicaid system? And I don't know if the federal government's going to be willing to play, but I think at this point they're looking at the same numbers nationally, of course, that we are. They're understanding what's going to happen to Medicaid, Medicare, and the other entitlements as this huge boomer wave hits those entitlements. And I think they're starting to think about a lot of different options that could be combined for states to try to rearrange their numbers. If you ended up with a model like this, we've said perhaps for the same amount of money, slightly less, you could cover even more people, because again, your expanded support would not be the full Medicaid but would be a limited general fund only, like an expanded OPI kind of model.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morse.
Yeah. When I was out of the room, I don't know if you talked about the people served on page six and the cost. You did talk about that? Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Morset. Yes.
Okay, from $11 million up to $2,200. Yeah, okay. That's a huge discrepancy, and the feds ought to be able to buy into that. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Chair, Senator Morissette, it makes absolute sense, but you need to look at Medicaid holistically and slow the rate of Medicaid growth by providing pre-Medicaid supports. I mean, it seems absolutely logical. So we're hoping we could get some traction with that. Now, the key to making any kind of transition like this, if we start down this road in the next year or two, and we've got a lot more planning with our stakeholders, a lot more budget calculations that we have to work through, we're going to have to launch a major discussion with our federal partners and with CMS, because one of the big issues, if you start changing benefit packages, is what happens to people that get caught in between. Historically, when you try to cut over from one federal program to another, the federal government has not allowed you to grandfather. And there's an important distinction here, because the new state plan option that's coming online is tied to 150% of the federal poverty level, which translates to about 200% of the SSI, which is roughly $1,400 a month. And Oregon's income threshold is 300% of SSI, which is almost $1,700 a month. So if we switched and we said everybody coming new into the in-home program below a certain hour threshold had to meet the new income eligibility, that would be one thing. But if you said then everybody in the existing waiver would have to meet that, you'd end up throwing people out of service, which is simply untenable. So the discussion will have to be with the federal government. If we can use some of these new waivers, state plan options, OPI in different combinations, can we grandfather? So that basically you would target new enrollments and you would grandfather existing people, so there would be no harm done or no loss of benefits. I think that's the only conscionable way that we could do this kind of approach. And we think they'll be receptive. Some of the national researchers working with the federal government believe they will give the states some latitude here, although historically they have not. But again, we trended this from 2006 to 2025 because we don't want to alarm people and show, well, a year or two from now we'd shift all kinds of different groups into different service categories, which would create a lot of panic of people fearing they would lose their benefits. That kind of planning, that cutover would have to be done very, very carefully with our stakeholders and with federal recognition of the harm that comes if you simply change benefit levels and income requirements. So that's a process that once we get the federal regulations this next August, I think we'll be deep into planning in the fall months, negotiations with the federal government, and perhaps by early next year or even by your February session, we may well have a state plan option mapped out and costed out that we can present formally for approval.
Discussion on this, please.
So that's the direction we're going with the long range plan. We're continuing to meet. We have a large task group. We again, this is all is a work in progress. Our goal will be to get much more detailed plans, both on sort of the community readiness part and potential changes to the Medicaid system by the end of this year. Our hope is to go back on the road all over the state by early next year to meet with elected officials, community leaders, county commissioners, city councils, to begin to talk about what that might look like and to take the individual kind of county-by-county data that Julia described and really begin to translate that into some real local numbers that people can get their arms around as well. So the numbers are daunting. Doubling this caseload over the next 20 years, given all the cost pressures that you all face, is a very, very daunting issue. But I think we're excited that we can build on Oregon's long-term care system, preserve choice, all the key values that we've held dear, but begin to move the system in some different directions that will be more sustainable and actually be able to serve more people by the time we're done.
In your process of educating, I hope the long-term care insurance come up for those people who can afford to pay it. Because as I looked at your pyramid, mm-hmm. and I see the cost going up, and I look at, as all of us, especially get older, the cost of health care and the cost of being in these centers is going to be great. And it would appear to me that
a word to the wise should be sufficient as you educate, that you educate on this piece as well.
Actually, Madam Chair, we plan to have some long discussions with the industry fairly soon. We've worked with DCBS, and they've actually done some nice reforms around the long-term care insurance product, but we want to get with the industry and say, if you'll do a good product, I mean, it has to be a good product. It has to be affordable. It has to be timely. We hear, you know, still stories of people that are paying for years and then eventually can't afford the premiums or don't get covered for what they thought they had bought into. But if people, if the industry will provide a good product, we in the public sector will help market that product. I mean, we won't sell a specific product, but we, and through our field, will really promote affordable long-term care insurance for exactly that reason. Because, again, there's a real incentive. We can exempt their estate recovery and provide some real financial incentives to do it. But it's got to be a good product, and that's the key concern.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, with that, we wanted to turn to current caseloads and bring up Judy Moore Peterson and really show you where the current caseloads stand and where we see the next biennium going in our caseload forecast.
Madam Chair, we're shifting now away from OPI.
We're going to current, yes.
Before we do that, then, I want to make sure that I get something on our record to add to my previous statements and concerns about the funding levels for OPI, not only the funding level, but the funding source. And again, what we're hearing from the Senior Disability Caucus and what I'm also hearing from folks in my county, Multnomah County, is the fact that we need to restore the general fund commitment to OPI, $12 million, that we need to support the governor's proposed increase to OPI. The governor's budget level was at $4 million, which also addressed the growth in the senior population. We need to protect the funds in the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program for the expansion of OPI to serve the younger disabled. And then, lastly, Madam Chair, we all just need to be mindful that if the co-chair's budget is allowed to pass and there are no monies coming from the general fund, the funds from the property tax deferral would not kick in until February 2008. And Mr. Tate, you can tell me if I'm correct about that. That means if general fund support is lost, that OPI funding would not be available from July 2007 through February 2008. And that would be unacceptable given the current caseload, but also the fact that we have members that the number of seniors needing OPI services is growing. And then I would remind us that this is a program that allows seniors to maintain their independence, maintain their dignity, and we have a real challenge as lawmakers, policymakers, to figure out how we can increase the funding for OPI.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
I saw a look on Julia's face of incredibility. Are those figures correct?
No, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, we were not viewing the fact that the revenues from the Department of Revenue on this fund source come in next year would create a disruption, that we would discontinue OPI for the first 6 or 8 months of the biennium. We viewed that as an allocation that we would spread over the entire biennium and would spend the general fund first and then replace it as those. So our total allocation for the biennium in the governor's budget would be $16.6 million without a disruption in the first 6 to 8 months. And I think that's the way we were planning on it, and not allowing it to go off the cliff for the first 6 months. I'll check with our budget staff, but that was
true. That is true.
Thank you for that information.
And I trust Mr. Tate that it would be very nice to, I know it's on the record now, but I personally would like to have that response back in writing that there will be no disruption. We sweat blood, sweat, and tears over the years on OPI, and I agree with my colleague from Multnomah County. It seems like every session, we're having to address OPI, and yet it is the one program. It just really is mind-boggling. It's the one program that we all know that helps to keep the seniors in their home, provides the dignity and what we all strive for. And it's kind of interesting when we have to, every session, talk about funding or gaps and what have you. So I would feel comfortable, more comforting, if I knew that that's a fact, that there will be no disruption.
And Chairman Senator Winters, I'll be happy to put that in writing.
You guys don't trust your chair, do you?
No. Yes, we do.
I know you don't.
Yes, we do.
Trust but verify.
Yeah. What am I wrong? Mr. Britton?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Moore Peterson, and I am the manager for the CAISO Forecasting Group. We do the CAISO forecasts for most of the major programs within the department, including for seniors and people with disability. So we've supplied a supplemental information like we have for the other divisions, and I thought I would walk you through what just 2007-09 looks like. I know you've been focusing out there out to 2025, and we are also very interested in participating and actively engaged in those kinds of planning processes. But we also need to focus on the here and now for the next budget cycle. For seniors and people with disabilities, we divide those caseload into three major caseload groups. They are the in-home services, they're community-based care facilities, and they're the nursing facilities. One thing of note is that the in-home services includes the home care workers, spousal, and live-in. It does not include the pre-Medicaid, the non-Medicaid OPI. So this is focused on just those.
So, could you read the assignment you just said one more time for
me? Yes. The seniors and people with disabilities and physical disabilities focuses on three separate kind of groups of caseloads: the in-home, community-based care facilities, and nursing facilities.
Okay.
And because there has been a great deal of discussion regarding OPI, I just wanted to make a note that because that is not in the Medicaid funded, the projections here are focused on just the in-home, not including the OPI services. So, okay. Is that
question on that, please?
Okay. On the first two pages is a narrative summary, and then following that are a series of graphs that focus on the history, the projections, and then the risk forecast that we've discussed before. On the in-home services, for the past 3 years, after the budget cuts that led to a lot of people dropping off or not being not qualified for services any longer, for the past 3 years, that particular caseload has been relatively flat, if not declining to a degree. The reasons for that are multifold. They include there were increased client eligibility reviews to make sure that we were consistently applying the rules to that particular population. There was also, with the implementation of the Medicare Modernization Act and Part D, there's been increased demand. There's less of a need for seniors or people with Medicare to walk in the door for some of the more complex services because they're receiving that prescription drug benefit. And then also that there, because of the a cutback in the acuity levels for the activities of daily living that occurred in the budget cuts of 2003, there are fewer people who qualify for those services as well, for the in-home who need those. For the community-based care facilities, that's made up of several different kinds of community-based care, including assisted living facilities, adult foster care homes, residential care facilities. They have had kind of opposite trends. The adult foster care caseload has been dropping pretty steadily since the budget cuts, and is only now we're starting to see it sort of stabilize, and we are anticipating it to continue that stabilization trend, in part because the program area will be actively recruiting and having a staff person help to recruit adult foster care homes, but they hope it will be a successful effort. We've also seen, we saw an increase in assisted living facilities and residential care facilities for a period of time, and just recently now we're watching those kind of trend flat, if not decline in some areas. We believe that is due to the interactions between the Medicaid market and the private pay market. I don't know, James, if you wanted to describe that or you would like me to take that one.
Well, I'm actually going to talk about that tomorrow.
Okay, so we'll just leave that for now. And then the nursing facilities had been steadily declining for a number of years. That is in large part due to a couple of different factors. One of them is that there were fewer people coming in for services as they went into community-based care facilities or in-home, that they were delaying how soon they needed to come in for care. We also saw, over that time period of those reductions, the length of stay, the length of which people were staying in the nursing facilities was reduced over time. So you had coupled with that, so you had fewer people coming in and fewer people, then they're staying less time. So we had those reductions until recently. Recently, we've started to see that nursing facility caseload start to level off. And in part, when we look at the length of stay trends, we see that they're not getting any shorter, that probably has maximized. It's not going to be able to get very much shorter given the acuity levels of the needs of the people who are coming in. And then there's likely to do, there's more people starting to come in. And that is reflective of the upcoming demographic. What you will note is that a lot of those trends aren't, the population isn't expected to double in the next 2 years. That is a trend that's a long-term trend, and that by 2025. So we'll start to see some of those increases at the end of the 07-09 biennium and also trending into the 09-11 biennium. And of course, if the program reorganizes and how they authorize services, then of course those trends would be expected to change. And that's it. Questions?
Just one point of clarification, and that is that when you see the fall 2006 forecast on these charts, that is the forecast that was used to build the governor's recommended budget. The spring 2007 forecast, which in most of these instances is different, is the one that will be used for the department's reshoot. So that's important to note that.
If you wanted to walk through some of those graphs, if you turn to the page 3 of 8, the black line shows the solid black line shows the history. The triangles show the additional data that has come that came in between when we did the fall forecast and when we did the spring, the forecast we just completed, the spring 2007, which Mr. Britton is correct that would be used as the basis for the reshoot. The black boxes are the fall 2006 line, and then the circles, the empty circles, are the spring 2007. I also would like to call your attention to the dotted lines. Those dotted lines are the expected variation from the forecast. One can reasonably expect, the further out one goes, that the projections, when we actually get there, that they're going to vary from what our projections are. And so this provides you with an estimate of what one can reasonably expect 2 years from now or 3 years from now. Questions? Representative Cortez?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm really concerned about the decrease in in-home care because, as we see, the assisted living and the residential care going up, which my understanding is that would be more expensive than the in-home care. Is that a correct assumption? Can we talk a little bit more about the barriers in the in-home care chart and why those numbers are going down? And is the population that's leaving that going into the higher cost facilities? I guess, I don't know if you have any of that as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, overall the numbers in the senior disability program have been flat or slightly declining, and that's mostly an artifact still of the 2003-2005 service reductions where we eliminated, again, we talked yesterday about the service priority levels, it used to be 1 through 17, with 17 being the lowest level of impairment. We cut, or initially the department in the budget crisis cut 10 through 17, the legislature restored up to 13. So the eligible population now is 1 through 13. So the 14 through 17 group, we in the spring of 2003, I think, sent out over 5,000 notices of termination of services of people that fell in those categories. And obviously that was the heaviest in-home group. I mean, you would expect people with lower impairment levels to really use that program. The other thing that Judy mentioned is that was also before Part D of the Medicare Act. And so if a person was long-term care eligible, even if they only needed a minimal number of hours, in many ways to become long-term care eligible was the only way they could get their drug coverage as well. So I think you've had two things happen. One, you've cut the eligibility. You provided a benefit that people otherwise might have used the in-home program simply because they needed the benefit. And it's caused a tremendous dislocation in our entire field. I mean, it was a real shock. If you look at the caseload trends before 2003, they just kept going steadily up, with the exception of nursing homes, which kept going steadily down. So that really, I mean, that if you look at that graph, you have the big drop-off there, which was in the in-home program. And again, it was mostly people at sort of the lower end of needed in-home hours. We then turned in 2003 through 2005, the entire assessment process became a much more defined eligibility process. In the old days, if you were eligible up to level 17, you got in the door, you got basically any choice under the home and community-based waiver. I don't think we ever imagined that we would turn that into a discrete eligibility tool, but that's what happened as we shifted that whole Medicaid program. These numbers are not going to stay down very much longer, at least I don't believe. I believe it will start trending back up again, but you're still seeing that suppression from...
Tell the committee about how many people are we talking about from the top of this piece in 2003 to that dip. How many people are we talking about?
Just over 2,000.
Great. The other response, Representative Kotek, in-home isn't always cheaper. I mean, it historically has been cheaper, but in the old days, the department just paid an hourly wage, no benefits, no health insurance, no workers' compensation. And so one would expect that as we've collectively bargained this program and people now get the benefits, workers' compensation and coverage, that the costs have gone up as they should have. We're at a point now, though, where if you're at about 4 or 5 hours of in-home care a day, you're about at what the base foster care rate would be. So in some cases, you could actually say it would be cheaper to serve certain people in 24-hour care than in-home, which would never be their choice, of course. And that's not something that we're trying to drive the system to. But particularly, I mean, we have people with really complex needs that we support at home with two and sometimes almost three shifts a day of in-home care, and that exceeds even the nursing facility rate of care. It's often younger people with disabilities, and we honor that. But in-home care is not always the cheapest. In many cases it is, but not always.
Thank you. I think this is a natural place for us to stop today, and then we will take up tomorrow. Any dying questions you have, things you have answered before we come back? Thank you very much. Committee dismissed.